Welcome back to another episode of Nerding Out with Victor. Today, I have a hacker with me on the show, an RFID hacker that goes by the name Iceman. Welcome to the show, Iceman.
Thank you so much for having me, Victor. It's a pleasure.
It's a really fun thing to have a hacker on the show. And I've seen some of your DEF CON talks, and you've done some amazing things. And today's episode is going to be all about RFID hacking, or RF hacking, I guess, more than RFID. So, yeah.
No, it's going to be RFID hacking. Hacking, it's not the same. Radio frequency is a completely different set of things, and RFID is a little bit smaller. So you can just quick thingy for you there. RF is about the full spectrum with SDR, software-defined radios, and you go for all the spectrum. RFID hacking is very limited to a certain frequency. So there's a low frequency, 125 kilohertz and 134 kilohertz. You have a high frequency, about 13.56 megahertz. And then you have ultra high frequency, RFID, UHF. And that's about 800 to 900 megahertz. And that's the only frequency we touch. We are very similar to RF in that sense, because we're into the radio frequency or communications over the wires, wireless, of course.
Right.
But it's not that. So we also do a different thing. The low LF and HF is about what's called inductant communications. So we don't do pushing out signals. But UHF does that. So a little crossover.
All right. So a bit gray area, but fair enough. That's a good distinction. So if you do have your SDR software or hardware, you cannot necessarily do this, or can that be used for the same?
You can. It's a very good question, though. It's a great question. Some of the people who have SDRs, like with Lime SDRs or Blade RF, or Heck RF. Yeah, exactly. And you use a better antenna, so you can actually get down and sniff a little bit better sniffing, because you can easily catch up and the signals that comes out. So just short introduction to what it does, RFID does.
Yeah.
You take a Proxmark, for instance. It's an RFID reader, and it has an antenna on there, and it generates a field, an electromagnetic field. And you put a... you take a card, an RFID-based card, right? It also has an antenna in here. So when you present that card into the field of a reader, it energizes because the magnetic field couples, so the resonant in the same frequency, we are tuned to the same frequency, and that makes the electron walk and excite the electrons, right? So this one gets power by coming into the field over here. So with SDRs, they can sniff this communication because we have a field that pulses out and it goes further on, of course, but it doesn't send, right? We don't pulse out.
So you can't power the chip or the card from the SDR, but you can read the
chip. You can sniff it.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Ah, good. All right. That's a really good distinction. So I got really excited about RFID hacking a few years ago. I lived in an apartment complex in London, and they only gave you like one fob for my building. And I was really annoyed by that because I was like, well, can I get another one? They were like, oh yeah, that's £200. I'm like, that's stupid. And it just so happened I went to DEF CON the same year. I was like, surely there is a better way for doing this. So I picked up one of these RFID cloners that you can buy for, I don't know, like $100 or whatever. It's not that expensive. Unfortunately, that didn't work for this particular use case because I did not know what technology to use for the fob. But it kind of opened my eyes to the world of RFID hacking. And I've kind of been intrigued by that since. And that's kind of why I wanted to get you on the show to just properly nerd out about all things RFID. So maybe we can start with kind of like the one-on-ones, the basics of RFID. Like, there are families of different types of RFID cards and readers and readers and categories of traffic, I guess, or frequencies. And I presume what happened to me was that RFID clone I had could not do that particular key fob, but it can probably do other things. So maybe we can start there. Like, can you break down like the categories of different types of key fobs and
wow,
room keys? Yeah.
Wow, this is a wide topic.
Yes, I would imagine so.
I usually get questions about that, you know, RFID hacking. Can I clone my card? It's the number one question, without a doubt, right? And fully fair. No, and people go like, how hard can it be? That's the next one, right? And then they go like, I bought a cloner.
Right.
And it didn't work. And you're like, haha. And now you enter the realm of RFID hacking. Is one first step you have to do is actually what you just figure out. You have to identify the technology that's being used. Yeah. And then I need to figure out, does the cloner understand that technology and have a way to actually make a copy of that card? Does there exist a way to do that? Because all technologies or all cards are not clonable, right?
Right.
So we just start that out of questions. Like when people go like, can I clone my passport? Yes and no.
Like, how much money do you have and how much time do you have?
it's like you can't, and that's the whole thing. But some people can, and you know, that's end of story. Same thing with payment cards. Is
right.
Without a doubt, second question is like, can I clone my? I want to be able to pay with my implants. Biohacking is a big thing because they make these implants on your hand and you put a little chip inside.
I've seen that.
They want to pay with your hand. It's really cool, right?
Yeah.
And but it's still, you have to move over the EMV data onto your chip. And that's, EMV doesn't really like that. So MasterCard and Europay, they really don't like that thing. So they want to have control of it. So they put on the cryptographic keys on the factories and very hush about it. But you can do a semi version of it. Another thing that works for payments is downgrade attacks. You can do replays and stuff like that. That is kind of obvious because the traffic for EMV is not encrypted. But you cannot clone it per se, right?
Right.
Back again to the thing, yes, you can, but you can't. that's the end of the story. It's like, I can't do it either, so it's okay. Right. I can make a copy of some things, but I cannot do it so it works always, right?
Right, right.
So now we've already touched base of payment cards, what you can and can't do. And then the topic of cloners comes in. You showed off a Kesey.
That's right.
Yeah. And that's Kesey was fun. I met the inventor in Ascension a couple of years ago, actually. He was doing, you know, developing his, like you said, we talked about hardware before a little bit. And he was doing his first revisions and down there. And it's really hard to make business in China sometimes if you don't speak Chinese or Mandarin. And bring it up. So apparently he was there for a year and then he went over to Mexico and finalized it there. Anyway, the Kesey is kind of interesting because it clones low frequency. So it targets with 125 kilohertz tags, right? That's usually only used for entry systems, simple entry systems. Kind of popular from where we come from, Scandinavia. It's lots of those low frequency tags, but you can do that.
Key card for your hotel room and so on, right? Is that a common use case?
Yeah. And now I have to do one thing. Wait.
Because that was the next thing I did. Like the next hotel I stayed at, I was like, all right, surely I could use this case.
Yeah. My headset just went bananas for me, so I can't hear your voice very well now because it's what it is. I have to do one thing. Wait.
That's all right. That's all right. Some hardware hacking live on stage.
Let's see. Are you back?
Yeah. Can you hear me? Great. Perfect. Yeah. So these are used mostly for access systems then, for like hotel rooms and for buildings and so on, right? Oh, okay.
No. Usually just passage entrance to doors, like simple doors to office buildings and stuff like that, fraternities like that. Here comes another thing. Let me just bring something down.
Yes. Love some hardware.
We love hardware. Hold on. So, Kesey works by, you know, very easily. You put the card, you put your little reader, it's very smooth. You put it on and put it on the card, and then you put it on where you want to clone it to. Very simple. Yeah. That stemmed from this little device. This is what we call the blue gun cloner. This is a low frequency EM cloner. So, it has these two little buttons, read, write, and that's what it does. It's like, beep.
So this is what, this is like standard issue red team kind of equipment.
Oh, this is what you saw back 2010. I'm pretty sure they had it. Oh, yeah. Then comes the new and better versions and more expensive models. You know, things like this. The iCopy 100 or something like that. This takes low frequency, has a UI and graphical and all that stuff. And it does high frequency as well.
Right.
And then comes even more modern versions of it. That's an iCopy X, which is speaks and all that stuff, and it copies and clones and
it can write as well. So it can call. Okay, cool.
Yeah. So most of these ones here are more advanced, so they can read up things and do more, and they support very much more different card technologies, because that was something else we were asking about. So first, we just end up with cloners, right? So it's a tons of cloners, and you need to know which one works for my system. And you sit there now, you're like, how do I know my system? Well, you use something like this. This is a simple field detector. So it lights up. If you have a RFID signal or something like that behind it, you will see that it lights up. And let's see if we can do it like this. Let's see if, oh, it's not battery in that one. Let's do it like this. Can I do this? Can I do this? Yes. You see how it flashes?
It blipped.
Because that's the phone. Your phone is an NFC reader, high frequency, right? So this is what it shows. Oh, right. This was a high frequency, and you see it here on this one. You would have presented this one to your reader, what you wanted to clone, and see like if it's low frequency or high frequency. That would have been one of the things. Another thing you would have done is like you look at the cards and look at the antenna that's in the card and see how many coils it has wrapped around.
Oh.
Right? Yeah. Few coils, high frequency. And tons of coils, massive, is low frequency.
And they are probably smaller radius too, I would imagine, on the antenna.
It's all kinds of styles. So it's not obvious, but you know, you see about the amount of wires there are. So it's like, okay, that's a good indication. Some of these cards has dual tech or even triple tech. So you have like three different kinds of technology in one card.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Oh, yeah. It gets worse. Yeah, so this is fun, right? So you start out with your card, and you had a cloner, and you're like, oh, damn, I couldn't do it. And it's like, it has to be something better. Yes.
Right.
It has to be. And I'm pretty sure that you just bought one, because here's a flipper.
I literally just ordered a flipper this morning, so yes, absolutely. Everybody needs to have a flipper, right?
Everybody needs to have a flipper, because this has an SDR, it has two pins I.O., GPIOs, and it has low frequency and high frequency, and a simple UI and stuff, so it's very easy.
And it implements a great ecosystem.
Yes, with apps and everything. Like, well, yeah, by the way, they are actually in London, the headquarters.
Are they?
Oh, yeah, they are. Now we know. We can visit their place.
Indeed. I was there last weekend. I'm going to come and knock on the next time I'm in London.
Yeah, you better do that. Like, say hi. Hi to Pavel and all those guys. Those guys met a million, but that is a super success.
Oh, yeah. Massively. Massively. This is super cool. So we now know. So we use these first devices, and that narrows down kind of like high versus low, right? So now we have like two buckets of card readers, I guess. And then I would imagine there is 10 families in each of those that you need to be aware of.
So for low frequency, there's like tons of them. I think it's about, we have a support for it, it's about 20 of them in the Proxmark code, right? And in the HF world is five big families. You have a ISO 14.43A, B, and then you have 15.693, and then you have 18,002. There's one more.
Yeah.
Too many.
and
PicoPass and all that. It's versions of it. Anyway, it's different families. I'm so excited. I'm just interrupting you all the time. No, sorry for that.
Good content. I love it. I want to learn more. I want to absorb it like a sponge here. So that's amazing.
I think it's just too fun. Anyway, so all of these cards and tags and all that stuff, this is how I ended up in this world, is because I did as you did. I was like, I want to learn to hack something. To be really honest, it's like my story started out where I was separating and I was very depressed. And I was like, I've been doing programming and hacking all my life. But I was not happy. I was not content. So I thought, like, let's see if I can do something naughty. And let's buy something naughty. I'm going to buy myself a hack or two. Never done that in my life because that's illegal and all that stuff, right? And here's the thing. In Umeå, one of the towns up here in North in Sweden, there was this news article about how the local hackerspace actually managed to break the keys of that bus ticket system. And I was like, oh, yeah.
Right. Plenty of stories like that over the years.
Yeah. And they are the same as here in my town. That's where I'm from. I was like, okay, I want to do that. So I went online and like Googled a little bit, and then, you know, the name Proxmox comes up everywhere. I'm like, and it's very expensive, $300. I'm like, okay, I'm going to do it for me. I'm going to order one. So I ordered one, you know, and all excited. You little, like, little boy, you know, all get it up.
Yeah.
2 weeks later, you know, you get this package from Alibaba or whatever it was, you know. And I will show you. Wait. It comes down. It doesn't even come in a plastic box. It comes like this, like a circuit board like this. This is Radio Wars versions of it, a little bit of one. I have so many versions of Proxmox nowadays. I don't know why I just have it. The old better is like, and this was an awful model. It was great because it was the first model that was actually assembled and you couldn't get like this. Before that, everybody has to solder their own things. It wasn't sold together. So that was a thing. It
looks like it's a lot of small components together. That's right.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not a good solder.
No.
I'm not that good at soldering.
No, me neither. But I'm better now, but not then. Anyway, so I'm like, oh God, I'm going to do this. I'm like, you know, get on the forum, the Proxmox forum, and try to do this. Try to set this one up. It's like, oh, it's Ming V and all that stuff. And people go like, I don't know, have you read the instruction guides? I'm like, no, I'm good at computers. I should be able to do this. So, of course, I failed. And I took it very hard in myself because, like, well, I'm worthless. So I couldn't handle it. So I put it away. I have a little shelf up there. So I put it up there and I was like, and it was reminding me every day. It's like this cat laying up there, despising you, looking down and despising you. I could look up there and I'm just like, oh God, my failures. It took me 6 months. It took me 6 months before I was ready to learn. You know?
Right.
When I was like accepting myself, saying, you're not very good at this, Iceman. Iceman didn't exist by Kaban. You know, he didn't. So after 6 months, I was like, okay, where's the guide? Then it's like, let's do that. You know, that worked. You know, you pull the Git clone repo and it compiled. Wow, that's great. And then flashing firmware on an embedded device. I never done that. And it worked. It's like, oh great. Run the client. Oh, the Proxmox client comes up. I'm like, damn. It's like, where is my tariff bus ticket system card? And I put it on, you know, and I run this command. It's the MIFRA classic technology. So you run this attack called HFMF dark side, the dark side attack. Mm-hmm. And you run it and it says, you know, 25 seconds average runtime. And you sit there and wait and it goes. Doot, doot. And then out comes the first key. And I'm like, I'm a hacker. The dopamine rush of that first key, I still remember it.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. So people go like, huh? What do you mean? It's like, it's intense. I don't know how it is for yourself, but first time you do something like that and you're like, I have done something amazing.
Yeah.
And everybody says, congratulations, you broke your first key.
Christ, you finished the readme. Good.
You know, like, we're all newbies, right?
Yeah.
So, but that's, you know, who I am. It's like I always keep on asking questions. I'm very curious. I was really hooked into this big, deep rabbit hole we call RFID hacking. And it never ends. So one of the things with the Proxmox world and what you learn very fast is that they're talking about the Proxmox can do everything, but you have to implement it yourself.
It's like software. You can do anything. You just have to build it yourself.
Exactly. You just have to learn to do it yourself, man. It's like nothing. And this is the thing, what I started doing. It's like, oh, yeah, but I'm quite good at that. So let's learn C again and learn about embedded and doing that. And I started doing things. But it was a rough place. So Iceman was just a user then.
Right.
But after a year, I think I posted, I know, I'm the guy who asked most questions on the old Proxmox forum. I think I asked more than 6,000 questions. I kept on asking everything. I was like a bottomless. Because the only thing I had was a Proxmox. And I did things based on that. And I changed code because I can't do that and stop fiddling with things. And I realized, you know, that, you know, maybe you want to do things the hard way. You know, you should be reading a raw signal trace and then you see a plot window and you should be able to manually decode that to bits and ones and zeros. And then, you know, and from there you should be able to twist and decode that one into a vegan pack stater, maybe. And I'm like, interesting. I learned that now, but not very functional because I can't use this. If I have to do this every time I want to look at the card, I'm going to go nuts. So I started doing those changes because I wanted something that the Proxmox client to work in the way that I want to work with it, how I want to see it, right? So I forced, you know, you start changing the tools in the way that you want to do it. So this is how I became very good at the Proxmox thing. And most of my changes was like, the old people who were running the repo was like, maybe why do you want to do it so easy? Why do you want to do that? Very protective OG people. And I was like, what's the year in or something like that? And then I realized, well, I can just make a fork of it. And then Iceman Fork was born. And then I did my changes there. I made sure that the upstream things comes in as well. And it didn't matter what the wanted or not wanted, I can just do it how I wanted it to become. And I did
it. Open source.
Yes. And it starts, that's the beauty of open source. Yes, I love it. And it started with that idea of always becoming more and more and more useful. You know, things work better. You know, and another thing that adds in the beginning there was the static analyzing, this continuous, covert scan, that's what it's called, but make analysis from it because it's C code and we always have memory leaks and all that crappy code styles. And the Proxmox world was full of it. But, you know, gradually you start taking away all of those problems, starts to become better and better and better. And you figure out more and more formats. We figure out more and more how to clone, how to read more and LF stuff, enhanced and made the, you know, high tag, or not just the high tag, the Mayfair classic attacks. Made them better, working more, faster, and all of that started, ended up. So this is where Iceman started showing up everywhere. This is where people know about the Iceman fork and who that is. This is why I ended up doing all this code. And from there, I never been into a conference, I never been to DEF CON, I never done anything like that, but I was all of a sudden a maintainer, and then I was also administrator of the Proxmox forums. And, you know, people was like, okay, you seem to burn for community as well, which I do. I'm very much for building a learning community, and we're always welcome to it. And that's why we also have a Discord channel now since a couple of years back. And the forum is not for people anymore. It's like the modern, the youth don't like, we don't like BBSs and that style.
I know.
It's Discord everywhere. It's great. Yeah. It's a fucking great, you know, we started with that during COVID. It was perfect. So we have like 11,000 members there.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Mostly lurking around, but it's good enough.
Sure.
But around 2017, I was involved with three other people, Zero XFF from Australia and Dennis and Olaf. Olaf is Proxgrind. He is the boy genius, or he's not boy anymore. he's almost 30. He's the genius doing very small Proxmox and miniaturizing hardware. We're a great Chinese person for that. And Dennis is the business unicorn doing networking and talking about things with stuff. So we created a little company called RRG, RFID Research Group, and we made the RDV4, an improved version of a Proxmox, small handled, easy, sleek, better antennas, and overall nice. And we made a Kickstarter out of that one, and that was actually very successful. So it came to fruition, and all of a sudden, I was like, yeah, we have to go out and talk about this product as well, or stuff like that. So I did that a little bit, and then started my career as talker on different conferences, and which I never done in my life either. So that was a big thing. I never been to conferences.
Right.
So this is another thing. I keep on talking. Sorry, you have to interrupt me.
No. This is great. I'm learning a lot. It's great. This is exactly what the stuff I wanted to cover. So this is perfect. I don't even have to.
I'm sorry about that. Yes, let me know. Anyway, so I started up and doing more and more things. I'm meeting people, and people is like always so touched by the efforts and doing the Proxmox stuff. And I'm like, wow. Like, you know, after the first talk, I remember a guy comes up and is like, thank you. Because of you, I've been having free laundry during my time as a student.
And I'm like, I'm sorry, I cannot know this. Please give us applause for deniability here.
And I'm like, I'm happy you learned. However, how about you don't rip off a small business person, right? It's just like, pay for your damn laundry. It's not hard. It's like, I get it, you know. So this is what I want to say when you talk about cloning your key fob for your apartment, right? This is where it actually comes in. People want to have a functional thing between this is a practical thing I can have advantage of versus the illegal part, which is I can make fraud out of it. You know, that's why people ask about payments and bus tickets and, you know, laundry or coffee machines or you name it, asked.
But that, I think that's, for me, it was always like the pursuit of understanding. Like, I want to understand how it works, right? Like, and that it made me realize, like, oh, shit, there's a crypto key in there that makes it harder to clone it. Okay, that's clever. And that leads you to, like, NFC, and now you're better grasping of, like, how NFC contactless pay work. And, like, because they're all kind of the same family of things, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. NFC is one of the worst names, though, because everybody says, RFID and NFC. And I'm like, no. RFID is the umbrella. NFC is a part of it underneath. Be sure that you keep it correctly. And people go, no, it's NFC. It's like, no. It's like, yes. Oh, no. But it's a task group, and they're very good at it. So within RFID is a lot of ISO standards, right? And work groups like NFC group, right? So they make an NFC readers, what you see in phones. They're very good at that. And they use a protocol that uses NDEF standard or something about NDEF messages. That's why you can send your business card and stuff like that over your phone like that, right?
Yeah.
There's also point-to-point network communications and stuff. It's very high tech, but it's another level on top, built on top of different ISO standards, how to communicate physically with cars, right? It's like a protocol on top of it.
Yeah.
And it's used for everything. But it always go across everything. So NDEF uses very much of APDUs. So for one of the systems. Payment system does the same thing. That's the ISO 7816. A lot of ISO standards now. But it's like a package, a wrapped package thing. Like you have a header, a 5-byte header, and then you have a data that you're sending, and then a CRC afterwards, right? So you pack it up so you can see it goes back and left, up and down. And you need to keep track of it. One of the things when you do an RFID hacking is that you want to look at the traffic that's happening, because just doing it, like having a reader writing, doing things, is good, but you don't learn anything from it.
Right.
And that's why the Proxmark is what they call the Swiss Army knife of things for RFID hacking, because you can look at the signal on the lower levels. You can look at it on the package tracements, in a sense. Like, we don't have Wireshark in that sense, but we have annotations and trace logs. There is a mode that you can actually export it to Wireshark. So someone made a Wireshark plugin for it somewhere. So apparently you can look at the ISO 14443A packages from there. I'm like, cool. Right. Yes.
So I think what's interesting, like, here is, if for the most basic cards, essentially it's an identifier, right? It's just like if you swipe the card and you get like a string of text, essentially, right? In various ways. But that the obvious thing is like, well, that's just a replay attack waiting to happen, right? So what are the mitigation strategies in place for some of these cards? Some of them have cryptographic IDs, so I presume there's a clock of sorts in there that generates a timestamp, so you like there's a time delay, like so you can't do a replay attack. Well, how does that actually look like? Or is it way too?
I hear that you're from a completely different set of of computers. Remember one thing now. RFID is an old, young technology, but it's very low power, right? The ICs on a card is very simple. So the simplest one from the low frequency we talked about before just shouted out the 5 bytes of information that was there, the EM4100. So the Proxmark was actually developed by a guy called Jonathan Vestues as in his master thesis, where he wanted to prove the state of the governor of California that the Veritas chips that they were trying to implement as an ID card for schools is crap, and you shouldn't do it because you can very easily capture the data and then replay it. So that's why he did this. That was 2006.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's where it started. Yeah. And then some other very smart people, researchers, starting attacking and looking into the more secure versions of RFID cards. So low frequency is usually very simple, right? There's one exception, and that's high tag. the high-tech family. Okay. And they have a crypto. So that's a Handshaker crypto. But it's also, it's very similar to my Crypto One because it's developed by the same people, by Philips. And they attacked that one and they recovered the keys how to do it.
Then so it has a crypto chip on there with a private key that is basically sealed.
It's not a crypto chip. It's only one IC, right?
Oh, okay.
So it's one system on chip in that sense that runs its things that have some crypto things that's hard coded into it in the beginning, right? So the more years comes, the more advanced the ICs became and they added proper crypto and proper dedicated more parts of hardware for it. And you can actually run like Java machines on it.
So like, a secured element style crypto.
Right. Stuff like that. So if you take an EMV cards, they are more likely running on a smart chip inside of there than an actual IC. Right? So 2006 and 2010 is when other researchers start hacking the MIFARE Classic cards and coming up with a crypto key that's ended up with me ending up in this world. And the same thing for you, going, oh, hold on. Those cards are more like a USB stick. They are like memory cards all of a sudden. They start screaming out the UID as well in an anti-collision process. But after that, they are like a USB stick, memory stick. It has memory and it's divided into sectors and blocks. Those sectors has two keys and access rights. So in order to get rid of the memory, in order to do a clone of a card, you need to break the keys, right? So that's how it improved. And in the more later ones, like the NXP Deathfire, they have added proper crypto like AES and encrypted channels and dedicated hardware and what is EIL 5 plus certifications. And so they're really good. You don't hack both.
Right.
Not me, not you.
And I would imagine the only way is to do some kind of downgrade attack on those cards then, if you were to, or is that even possible?
Oh, look at that. Someone has been reading up on things. Downgrade attacks is a concept, yes.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting concept because in physical access control world, this is more one of the standard attacks there, is that you have a reader and For physical access control vendors, they choose a protocol called VGAN to communicate between the reader and the microcontroller behind doors that decides to open the door strikes or not. And by doing so, you can easily swap out the readers as long as it's spoke VGAN. So you can put up a low frequency technology reader of different sorts, or you could put up a high frequency one that was for iClass or Deathfire or 14A or 14B, whatever you want to put on. As long as it spoke VGAN and talked back that way, the door opened.
And that's
right?
Just plain text protocol, right?
That was in plain text protocol, yes. That's why we do this on wire sniffing and all that attacks right. You've seen, right?
You get to that in a second, but yeah, yeah. Because I think that's worth zooming in on.
So the downgrade attacks is like, does the reader support multiple different versions of card technology? Does it support a legacy or a simpler version? If it does, Bob's your uncle. You just take the data out from VGAN wires, put that data on a lower secure credential, and then you have a copy. That works.
Yeah. And I mean, and that I think these things are like, well, what makes me love the concept of like red teaming, really. Like, you never attack the strongest security parameter. You always find for the weakest link. And in this case, it's just like, well, okay, you have all this fancy security to check the card, but if I just lift this out and put a sniffer behind it, like, what's the point? Like, it's not a complicated attack.
The thing with red teaming, when you talk to those guys and all the pen testers who do physical access, they always get in. That is the least of their concerns. It's like, we put on two multi-factors, biometric and all that stuff. They got in anyway.
Yeah, somebody left the door open. The cleaner forgot to close it. Like, cool.
Yeah. Like, you know, they're going to get in. That's not a problem. So, you know, and that's, this is where I start saying to people, for commercial properties like that, or for your entering your multi-tenant house, is it's secure enough. It gives you a feeling that it's secure and you can easily do it. but it's not secure. It's secure enough.
I mean, yeah, that's where I want to have another episode later on lockpicking, because I think that's equal interesting, because it's a perception of, like, people believe locks are safe. You believe key tags are safe, but to a great degree, they are not. Right?
Nope.
They are. It's an illusion of security rather than real security.
Yes. And what many people are interested in RFID hacking, Vincent, is that they want to tell the story that the vendors are saying something, and by the RFID hacking community, you have now the tools to prove if that statement is correct or false. Right.
So let's zoom in on that for a second. So a lot of alarm systems these days are using RFID dongles, both in commercial buildings, but even increasingly in residential buildings. It's becoming more like, if you buy a new lock, like, oh, do you want the smart version of your lock? More often, they're usually more stupid than smart, but that's a different thing. But when you go to, like, I don't know, Assa Abloy or whatever, one of these lock companies, and they sell you a smart lock, how secure are those? What standards are they using to actually secure this? Are they somewhat secure against cloning, or are they actually a downgrade from a traditional lock?
Yeah.
I like where this is going.
Well, okay. Let's see. Let's decode that one a little bit. One of the most common thing now is to have Bluetooth, BLE, right? So something that they call mobile credentials. So the mobile credential lives in your phone, it lives in a secure element, and it's very high crypto because the phone has the compute power and memory to do this stuff, right?
Yeah.
So that part is very secure.
Yes.
However, over and over again, this is outside of RFID hacking, because now we're going into different technology. So with Bluetooth, like something like everything else, right? As soon as you can capture the signals, because you can do that before, but once you start learning SDR and you start capturing Bluetooth signals and you know how to use the tools, you can also replay things, right? And if you don't have a session protocol in that sense in place, those simple Bluetooth locks is very like you just replay, you just, you know, record the first opening and then just replay it.
So you go by the day before, you put a little battery powered sniffer next to the doorway, and then you come back the next day. And
well, you don't have to do that ever. It's Bluetooth. It's designed to distance, right? So you just need a badass antenna. You can sit several meters away, hundreds of meters. When it comes to that, it's a completely different story. So this is why it's so fun when you go to DEF CON and you go to the Radio Frequency Village or RF Hacker Sanctuary. Right. So they teach all of that stuff there. They have an excellent CTF that you can play. So the RF CTF at DEF CON is well worth it. It runs by Ricks. Big shout out to those guys. And they are really good. So if you want to learn the latest and tricks and things, how to do things, you go there and you realize, oh my God. But this is yet again, it comes down to costs and administrative money to do this, to secure things. With Bluetooth and mobile credentials, as is right now, it's pretty secure. But as always, there are tons of interest. As soon as there's a lock, there's a tons of interest among people out there, and they're very dedicated to find out there's some bugs, and they want to prove to people that they can actually pass by and penetrate that system. So there were some interesting talks at DEF CON this year, talking about how the secure element on the I-class or the CIOS systems is not proper, or they managed to extract the key materials from that. And yeah, so and that's the same key material that is used for Bluetooth credentials as well. So yeah, it comes down to the keys in the end of the day. If you find the keys, somehow you can extract it. Over. It's game over. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you have the latest 4,000 bits or Diffie-Hellman or whatever shit you use.
If you have access to that, it doesn't really matter, right? So walk me back to like the toolkit that you use. So obviously you have your hardware, the Proc-Mark, and in terms of like, if you go back to the scenario where you're trying to do your cloning of your bust card that you had 10 years ago or 15 years, how many years back that was, How will that process look like with a Proxmox 3 today, or 4, sorry?
It's Proxmox 3, but AutoVision, AutoV4. It's okay. It's a silly world. It's a tons of that. But I usually say this, if you want to get started with RFID hacking, you don't need very much, right? If you have an Android phone, you can do a lot of HF stuff and learn from there. And otherwise, you just buy a $30 Proxmox Easy on Taobao or whatever you buy it, or Amazon, and you have something to start with. If you have more money, you can buy a very fancy flipper, and then you can do more stuff with that ecosystem. But it's a good entry system for it that you can learn to do things, but you will not understand how. Mm. It's a point and click. That's the cloner thing. This is one button click cloners, right? With me, I just started out with Proxmox. I had that one for 5 years. People were like amazed. Like, how many readers do you have? Do you have a logic analyzers? Do you have oscilloscopes? What do you do? And I'm like, no, I have a Proxmox. And people didn't understand I could do so much with it. And I was like, well, you know, I just use the tool that I have and I made it work better to it.
Right.
But today it looks completely different. I have tons of stuff.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine.
It's like, you know, the play tools from when you grew up, and all of a sudden you have more play tools.
That's right. That's right. And less time, but more toys, but less time.
Yes. Yes.
So if you wanted to crack a MyFair card, a MyFair classic card, that's kind of a super straightforward these days.
Fuck yeah, man. It's what we call autoporn. It's one command. You run autoporn, and within 2 to 13 seconds, it's done. You got all the keys, you've got all memory, and that's it.
And then you can clone and write your own key, and then you happy days, essentially.
Yeah. MyFair Classic doesn't have any security left in it. It had some. This is amazing research, by the way, what I was just presented. That's why we met up.
That's right.
Philip Turvin, Dojox, is a really, really good RFID hacker and a great researcher, and he works for Quark's Lab. And he has been deeply involved in an RFID hacking for years in different other projects. And he actually used to work for NXP and in doing the Death Fire cards in Generation 1 at Hertz. So this is a big shout out to him. He's a great guy. He's amazing. He's really smart as well. He's super smart. And what he came up with now is one of the cards that was left. So MyFair Classic came from original ICs from NXP. First one, the hack that we broke that. They made an improvement of it, and they call that MyFair Classic EV1, Evolution 1. That's how they call it, right? So that one was secure, came out 2010, I think it was, and then 2015 came up in a new attack called the Hard Nested Attack. So we have different names of attacks. So we have a dark side, the nested, the hard nested, and it sold these genuine cards. Genuine cards follow standard protocol and behaves nicely accordingly, and Bob Chonk. Right. However, there was a difference is because when you start doing things, there shows up illegal copies or sub-licensed copies of this IC, the MyFair Classic, right? And they are usually by Fudan, it's in microelectronics in China. One of them. Fudan is one of the big ones. And they had something that they didn't quite follow the protocol perfectly. So the attacks that used before the crypt keys is that you can figure out the nonsense is used, you can restart the PRNG that is used for it. But for Fudan cards, they had a different way of doing it. We saw one version that had a static nonce use and only once number. A random number is supposed to be used only once. Static means that it's not. It keeps on sending the same number. And it's like, okay.
Yeah.
And it was a problem with that. And till 2020, because then we had to figure out a way to get another nonce, and then we could all of a sudden recover keys for it, right? But there was another model of this one that we called the static encrypted nonces. And it had a dynamic first nonce, but the second one in the nested part of the authentication process was static. And it's really annoying as fuck because you can't do very much with it. However, Philip had a look at this in May this year, and he came up with some amazing findings, made this paper, research paper, that is gigantic. He's going to do a talk about this paper and his findings on Hardware.io in October. So it's a big shout out to him, and I don't want to, you know, take anything away from his jam. So I'm not going to talk very much more about the paper in pure respect that I want him to deliver his own message, right?
Fair enough.
But what he did find is a way to figure out things, but he started fuzzing authentication protocol, right? So you have to authenticate we have sector key over key A, you send 60, hex byte 60. If you want to authenticate with key B, you send a hex byte 61, right? And then the block number. Now, he was just, for the fun of it, he likes doing that things. Let me fuzz that one. What happens if I send 62? What happens, if I go up to 6F, right? Because why not? And then he found out some of the cars actually answered. So by fuzzing the authentication protocol, he got a nonce out of that. And it's like, holy moly. How come? And start to identify with categories of IC, what is that might be, and doing his context, whatever he has, and figuring things out and start collecting things. And he comes up with some amazing ideas about now I can reuse some data that we'd have here because we got two different ones. So the stat encrypt the nonce, he started analyzing that one back one. And then he realized that there is there's also an Android side jumping. It's an Android app and you can do things. And he looked at the API calls for that one. And it's like, he can look at the data and goes, oh, wait, I know that data. And he realized there's a key. And it's like, oh, what's this key? And it turns out it's static. So it's a backdoor key that answers to those unauthenticated, not genuine authentication protocol bytes, right? It has a static key, so you can read out the memories of his cards. That's his findings in his paper, and it's fucking amazing how he came up with that. He'd spent like 2.5-3 months about it. And I'm like, wow! Yeah.
That's amazing.
It is.
So, my fair classic, game over, in all shapes and form then.
Yeah, now it's game over. It's nothing there. But it's end of life since, I think, we call end of life 2012 or something like that. So, it's...
But the thing is, like, life cycle, these locks or whatever doorway, they will exceed that, right? They will be in use for a long period of time past.
Yeah. You know, how often do you change the door locks down there? It's like 20 years, right?
Right. When you buy a new house and you change the lock because you don't know who has the key previously, yeah. Right?
No one has the keys. And, we don't want to change the world. So you just want to change the reader. So you get the same reader that speaks Wigan anyway, because it's cheap. And those cards, my favorite classic cards is like, what, 6 cents a dollar now per card?
But I have a bunch here that I bought for testing, right?
Yeah. But genuine ones like Deathfire, the secure ones, is like 38 cents.
Right.
So it's a bloody difference in money, right? Yeah. So if you're a big company or a big house, if you take one of these modern houses, with multi-tenants in, and people lose the keys left and right and up and downs, it's a lot of money. If you go for hotel systems, it's even worse, right?
I mean, they're disposable, essentially, right, at hotels.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
So secure enough, remember?
Right.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. So then obviously there are more modern versions that people should be using, but we expect to see these for the next decade in real world at minimum, right?
It's very practical, right? Remember, you can just give them, you can give here, you can get in, use my card, you get in. It's practical. If you have a mobile credential, you're never going to do this. Take my mobile phone and go and open that door.
Well, what you can do with mobile credentials, though, which I think is interesting, one of the first, I forgot. I started an Airbnb in the Bay Area. This is a long time ago. And they have one of the first smart locks. And they had something very clever. This is before the whole Bluetooth key, but they had expiry. So you can grant people access for a specific duration of time.
Mm.
And then your credential automatically expires, right? Which is much better, right? Than giving somebody a key. Or if you want to give you cleaner access to your house, well, I know the cleaning's going to go on Wednesday at 9 a.m. Well, key's going to work between 9 a.m. and 11 a.m. And any time beyond that, no. Just no, right? So I think there is a lot of validity. And I think the same thing, in London you have the Oyster card, which was like the predominant way of paying for your subway fares, right? Has more or less been eroded for contactless. Like, nobody's using Oyster card these days because it's like, why? You have 5 contactless cards with you that you can equally well pay with.
Yeah, so but you can also pay with your phone, right? You just tap and pay, right?
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, that contactless in the sense of your phone or your watch or whatever it may be,
yeah,
kind of supersedes these cards or the need for cards. So
yeah,
my gut feel would be like they will probably be replaced by a software equivalent rather than the next generation of that, perhaps.
Here's the thing with it, though, with technology. It's like, I know that you and I, we like technologies for, you know, it's fun and exciting, and let's see if it has some bugs in it. But when it comes to credentials, remember, they always have to work.
Yeah.
So mobile credentials means that your phone has to have some sort of battery, which we usually have. But some of them needs, and if you have online verification, so your Bluetooth has to go to your lock and that one has to verify online, that has to be able to talk 24/7 to a something system to verify things, right? And if
NFC doesn't do that though. NFC can work, like Apple Pay, for instance, can work even if you have no signal, right?
Yes, it does, right. So, and you can also do it like up to 8 hours. This reserves some battery power for minimum things, right? Because you use your phone today even to start a car, right?
That was going to be my next thing I wanted to talk about. Yeah.
Yeah. So it I see it's like you see it as well. So mobile credentials and using your phone is going to be natural, but it comes to cost. The mobile NFC is not cheap. It's really, you pay extra, right? Remember, it costs 38 cents per dollar to get a card. And if you add 35 cents to that, you're up in 76 cents for a credential all of a sudden. But you can turn it off and turn it on and very easily because you can just sit and maintain that one. You say, yes, no, revoke his access. It's gone. That's not the same thing with cards, remember, if it's not up connected cards, right? Or readers.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, because like, I was renovating my house and we were looking at, like, should I get smart locks for every doorway? And I was like, the nerd in me really wants this, but the security person in me is this really a good idea or not? I was looking at the Unify Ubiquity office access stuff, which... That's probably a company I would trust with this stuff, but nonetheless.
I think Unify or Ubiquiti uses Desfire, so as card credentials is good enough. But then it comes down to cost as well for you. It's like, what do you want it? What kind of buck is it? How often do my cleaner come? Do I need it for that? Or...
Oh, it was purely a nerdery exercise, more so nerdery.
I get you.
Can I justify this as a expense rather than do I really need this? Because the answer is very much no, I do not need this. It's more like, can I justify it because it's kind of fun?
But I get it. I get it totally. It is fun, you know, and you always get curious, how secure is it? Yeah. And you can bet your bottom dollar on that there's a couple of people looking into just that system, and, you know, and bound to find something.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, that brings me on. You mentioned cars, and so I think I'm almost a bucket cars and consumer alarm system in the same bucket, because I would imagine they are somewhat similar in tech. Well, maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But let's start with cars. Like, what they use some kind of RFID, I would imagine, for like the authentication for the handshake, or is that completely different tech?
Well, here's the same thing again, right? So the old cars uses old technology. They have proprietary cryptos, DS40 and DS80 and DST40, DST80, I think that was called. And it's also called MegaMOS ID48. And then it's the HiTech 2 and the HiTech 3 and the HiTech Pro. It's a lot of things that goes on in the evolution of car entry systems. So you have two ways. You have the immobilizer system and the car entry. Car entry usually is dual frequency today. So the key fob sends an RFID signal to the car, and the car turns on and sends, or we present, I don't know which one it is. If you present the LF to the door, and then the car responds with a signal back. Or is it because when you press the button, you send an RF signal and the 433 megahertz field, or 314 megahertz, and the car responds back by looking if a key is near the reader. Yeah, like that is. So you have to present your key near your handle. So it's dual tech to enter the car. And then when you start the car, it's usually an authentication process with exchange crypto and say, yes, this is an enrolled key fob in the immobilizer system in the ECU. Yeah. However, there's no standard to it, right? No. Hotel system, car systems is not the same as PACS. PAX uses the vegan data, and then, you know, you can always find that one somewhere there. But in the hotel systems and in car systems, it's individual how that works.
Okay.
Yeah, tons of research going on, though. And yeah.
Yeah, because a friend of mine had his car stolen by one of the replay attacks. Well, not replay, the relay attacks, right? Where they basically, like, you had to put, like, they basically just, yeah, they have big antenna and they figure out your car keys probably going to be by the door. So they walk up to the door with the big antenna, relay that to the car, open the door, and drives away. Yeah. Right?
It depends on the car and system. You know, was it Toyota? Was it that you can open with a USB stick? You can just, as soon as you broke in, you can just put a USB stick into pop over plastic near the key holder, whatever, the ignition, and then you just put a USB stick in there, and the car was on. That was Hyundai. And that was very many stolen. Oh, it was a key. Same thing. But what we do with that relay attack, you know, is see the flipper. That's another research with rolling codes and making that you can get out of sync. So you record by being a distance when people open or unlock the doors, and then you can just replay those. It's not very good. No.
Yeah, car hacking is interesting as well for many reasons. Well, I think there was one attack on, I forgot what car that was. I think it was a Range Rover or something like that, where they found that if you remove the left front light, you could access the canvas from outside the car.
Yeah,
and
if you access
the canvas, like, game over.
Yeah. We do a lot of those things. I saw some videos from Ukraine. I had this interest this spring looking into high tech too, and it eventually always comes into, when you look into high tech too, there's a reason. It's because it's very close to car hacking. it's very popular for cars. It's one more case in England where you're from, is that the Paxton system uses high tech too for copying on cars. Once recovered the keys there, it turns, people get very, very careful because the car hacking and the car stealing, car theft, it's people are like, I ask around because, like, I needed some firmware for the ICUs. And, like, yeah, I'm looking this. And, you know, and people go like, I like you, Iceman. But why do you want that stuff for? It's like,
you're not getting close to my car.
It's like, you know, all of a sudden it was very dodgy and people get scared real. Like, I could ask people about EMV payment stuff and people are like, oh, yeah, you can do this and this and this. But as soon as you start talking about being interested in car hacking, people were very restrictive with sharing information all of a sudden.
I can imagine. There is probably a far higher price tag to sell toolkits for stealing cars on the dark web than there is to sell kits for, like, cloning a hotel fob, right? Like, there's a lot more financial interest in that space than there is, obviously, in passageways.
Oh, God. I can show you one thing. One more thing.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
I see you have the best social engineering kit behind you there, which is a high-vis vest. That's the best.
Yeah. It's from WiggleNet. I got it now at DEF CON. So big shout out to those people. It's like high-vis. I should have it. This is what I bought because this is a high-tech 2 cloner, and the software says you can clone BMW, Opel, and all these different things. But none of the software has the needed firmware files for it, so it's completely useless. So I was like, okay, where do I get those then? And it's like, no. So you see, this one is sold everywhere. But it's completely useless as is, and with software that you get.
Yeah. No, because I was looking at, I have on my car, I only have one car key on my car. So
do you have?
It's Passat, so not super sexy. Ooh. But I want to get clone. I was going to clone it.
How old is it?
It's a 2020, I think. No, 2016, I think.
2016? It could be a high tech too.
Yeah. So I was just thinking, like, can I clone it myself? And I was looking at that. There are a lot of people who can come and clone it for you. I was like, I don't really want some random dude show up my doorway, clone my car key, and give me a spare copy. And he's like, let me save that firmware real quick.
But of course, you know, let me hook up my gear to your CAN bus and program it for you, because that's how you do it. But I forgot to delete the files.
Exactly. But it's interesting, because I was like looking into how hard it is to buy the kit. And you can buy the kit. It's not that expensive to buy it. Well, it's far more expensive than buying a key clone, of course. But
yeah,
it's in the hundreds of pounds rather than paying somebody 50 quid to do it.
Yeah, or just 400 pounds?
Something like that. 400 quid or something like that. So I was on the verge of, like, purely from a scientific perspective, I kind of want to buy one of these myself.
About to buy one as well.
Yeah. just for shits and giggles, really. But
sure, whatever tickles you. Whatever. I was for the interest of learning.
Yeah, let's call that. But yeah, it's interesting that it's relatively accessible. These toolkits you can buy. I mean, Flipper is kind of the same category of like click and play security tool. So there is. Same thing for the car space, like things that can connect to the CAN bus and do a lot of funny things. I haven't really gone that far in my journey of car hacking, but maybe I'll...
But do you feel it now? Do you feel how it spreads out? I usually call RFID hacking that it engulfs all of hacking, right? It's low-level hardware, it's firmware extraction, it's crypto keys, it's software bugs, patches, or whatever, you know. It's really covers all of it, you know, and spreads out. It's not just this narrow little thing. Oh no, it's just this. It just spreads out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's used both for identity and for cryptography. And like, there's a lot of intersection about all things tech in the realm of RFID, which is super interesting. The last thing I want to cover is alarm systems. I'm curious about. That's probably the most common use case for RFID tags for consumers, home consumers today, because almost every alarm system you'd buy today, they would have an RFID-ish fob, right, with them. How much can you speak about that? Like, how secure are they? Like, how worried should one be about cloning attacks on those types of fobs?
It's kind of similar to Pakistan.
Oh, yeah?
So it's, if you go from our region in the world, where I said that they have a lot of low frequency tags, a lot of alarm systems in our region in the world has low frequency tags encoded into them. So that tells you a little bit about that one. And there are some with more, you know, with high frequency tags, but usually it's if it uses one of the card technologies that is normal, you know, that we already have full access to in ways of recovering the keys and access the memory, it is not a thing to make a copy of it, right?
Have you thought about brute force attacks for like alarm systems like that? Can you do like a brute force attack with something like an SDR-esque thing where you're just like, well, I know the identity looks like six characters, or it's a 6-inch, whatever it may be, right? Can you just like, are these alarm systems, for instance, sophisticated enough to prevent against a brute force attack, which like literally iterate to all combinations?
I don't think so, to be honest. I haven't looked into that one, but I doubt that they take those kinds of attacks in because it's not feasible that you're going to stand next to, when you're broken in and you're going to put your flipper there and like, tick,
no, one, but you could stand two. On the outside and just broadcast it, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. If it's RFID, like we did again with RFID, it's you can't transmit. There. Yeah, you have to be physically there. So that's the limit, right? You should be able, if you have access to the house, whatever, to do, you know, to make a simulation, and then you change the data that is needed to iterate the different things, and you keep on doing it until you hit the pay dirt. I mean, that's another way of when we do RFID hacking is to let the Proxmox or nowadays a flipper to simulate a tag, and then you see what comes out of it.
Right.
And you can simulate different things. Yeah.
Trial and error, essentially, right?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of fun. You can also make things go boop if you know how to fuzz 14A or whatever anti-collision protocol. If you know that, you can make readers go, holy moly, I didn't like this anymore. And you don't know what happens.
Overheat and just collapse, or? I would imagine that's another interesting attack factor.
DDoSing essentially.
Yeah, fair enough. all right. I think we covered a lot of interesting ground here, and I think there's probably like an hour worth more of content that we could be zooming in on, but maybe we'll break that into another episode for the readers and listeners to have a bit of a break. But I think this has been super interesting. I've learned a lot, and I have not even gone through all my notes yet because I had a few more here that I wanted to cover. But so I think that to be an episode part two for this one, where we dive into even more of these things. And through my backlog of your DEF CON talks and your other talks, I probably got a couple of more questions.
No worries, man. I like it. It's much appreciated to be on your show, man.
Really good. So, and if one wants to buy a Proxmark 3, where does one go and procure one of those?
Well, you just go to Amazon or eBay or AliExpress, Alibaba, and you buy something. I usually tell people don't spend too much money. If you're corporate and you're working as a pen test, you can spend the $200-$300 that you have to do for an RV4. It's worth it. But if you're like a hobbyist, buy a $30, make sure it's a 512 kilobytes of flash memory on it, and then you will run the latest firmware, the Iceman version, of course, on it, and you will have everything that's needed to be done, right? But the quality could be a little bit dodgy sometimes for some models. But that's why we have a Discord. We have in the Discord, we have a shopping channel where you get, you just ask there, and you will get a link to places where are known to sell great stuff, and I don't take sides anymore in that sense. I think it's just if you want to buy it in England, I can mention a lot of people who can sell it for you in England.
I can put them in the show links if you send over some afterwards, and I can put in links to the Discord channel as well, because it seems like a lot of stuff, that's where a lot of conversation is happening.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So I'll make sure to put that in the show notes. So good stuff. Much appreciated, Asmat. Very much enjoyed our conversations. And I guess until next time, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Cheers. Bye.